don't remember. I was in such a hurry.
Well, you might not believe it, but I helped the old man make up that slogan. If it's optic white, it's the right white.
He quoted with an upraised finger, like a preacher quoting Holy Writ.
I got me a $300 bonus for helping to think that up. These new-fangled advertising folks has been trying to work up something about the other colors, talking about rainbows or something, but hell, they can't get nowhere.
If it's optic white, it's the right white, I repeated, and suddenly had to repress a laugh as a childhood jingle rang through my mind. If you're white, you're right, I said.
That's it, he said. And that's another reason why the old man ain't gonna let nobody come down here messing with me. He knows what a lot of them new fellas don't. He knows that the reason our paint is so good is because of the way Lucius Brockway puts the pressure on them oils and resins before they even leaves the tanks.
He laughed maliciously.
They thinks 'cause everything down here is done by machinery, that's all there is to it. They crazy. Ain't a continental thing that happens down here that ain't as if'n I done put my black hands into it. Them machines just do the cooking. These here hands, right here, do the sweetening. Yes, sir, Lucius Brockway hit it square on the head. I dips my finger in and sweets it. Come on, let's eat.
But what about the gauges, I said, seeing him go over and take a thermos bottle from a shelf near one of the furnaces.
Oh, we'll be here close enough to keep an eye on them. Don't you worry about that.
But I left my lunch in the locker room over at building number one.
Well, go on and get it, and come back here and eat. Down here, we have to always be on the job. A man don't need no more than 15 minutes to eat nohow. Then I say let him get back on the job.
Upon opening the door, I thought I had made a mistake. Men dressed in splattered painter's caps and overalls sat about on benches, listening to a thin, tubercular-looking man who was addressing them in a nasal voice. Everyone looked at me, and I was starting out when the thin man called,
"There's plenty of seats for latecomers. Come in, brother."
Brother? Even after my weeks in the North, this was surprising. I was looking for the locker room, I spluttered.
You're in it, brother. Weren't you told about the meeting?
Meeting? Why, no, sir, I wasn't. The chairman frowned.
You see, the bosses are not cooperating,
he said to the others.
Brother, who's your foreman?
Mr. Brockway, sir, I said. Suddenly, the men began scraping their feet and cursing. I looked about me. What was wrong? Were they objecting to my referring to Brockway as Mr.?
Quiet, brothers,
the chairman said, leaning across his table, his hand cupped to his ear.
Now, what was that, brother? Who is your foreman?
Lucius Brockway, sir, I said, dropping the Mr. But this seemed only to make them more hostile.
Get him the hell out of here, they shouted.
I turned. A group on the far side of the room kicked over a bench, yelling, Throw him out! Throw him out! I inched backwards, hearing the little man bang on the table for order.
Men! Brothers! Give the brother a chance!
He looks like a dirty fink to me! A first-class enameled fink!
The hoarsely voiced word grated my ears like nigger in an angry southern mouth.
Brothers, please!
The chairman was waving his hands as I reached out behind me for the door and touched an arm, feeling it snatch violently away. I dropped my hand.
Who sent this fink into the meeting, brother chairman? Ask him that,
a man demanded.
No, wait, the chairman said. Don't ride that word too hard.
Ask him, brother chairman,
another man said.
Okay, but don't label a man a fink until you know for sure,
the chairman turned to me.
How'd you happen in here, brother?
The men quieted, listening. I left my lunch in my locker, I said. My mouth dry.
You weren't sent into the meeting?
No, sir. I didn't know about any meeting.
The hell he says! None of these finks ever knows! Throw the lousy bastard out!
Now, wait, I said. They became louder, threatening.
Respect the chair,
the chairman shouted.
We're a democratic union here, following democratic...
Never mind! Get rid of the fink!
Procedures! It's our task to make friends with all the workers, and I mean all! That's how we build the union strong. Now let's hear what the brothers got to say. No more of that beefing and interrupting.
I broke into a cold sweat, my eyes seeming to have become extremely sharp, causing each face to stand out vivid in its hostility. I heard,
"When were you hired, friend?"
This morning, I said.
See, brothers? He's a new man. We don't want to make the mistake of judging the worker by his foreman. Some of you also work for son-of-a-bitches, remember?
Suddenly the men began to laugh and curse.
Here's one right here,
one of them yelled.
Mine wants to marry the boss's daughter. A friggin' eight-day wonder!
This sudden change made me puzzled and angry, as though they were making me the butt of a joke.
Order, brothers! Perhaps the brother would like to join the union. How about it, brother?
Sir? I didn't know what to say. I knew very little about unions, but most of these men seemed hostile, and before I could answer, a fat man with shaggy gray hair leaped to his feet, shouting angrily,
I'm against it. Brothers, this fellow could be a fink even if he was hired right this minute. Not that I aim to be unfair to anybody either. Maybe he ain't a fink, he cried passionately. But brothers, I want to remind you that nobody knows it. And it seems to me that anybody that would work under that son-of-a-bitchin' double-crossin' Brockway for more than 15 minutes is just as apt not to be naturally fink-minding. Please, brothers,
he cried, waving his arms for quiet.
As some of you brothers have learned, to the sorrow of your wives and babies, a fink don't have to know about trade unionism to be a fink. Finkism? Hell. I've made a study of finkism. Finkism is born into some guys. It's born into some guys, just like a good eye for color is born into other guys. That's right. That's the honest scientific truth. A fink don't even have to have heard of a union before,
he cried in a frenzy of words.
All you have to do is bring him around the neighborhood of a union, and next thing you know, why, zip! He's finkin' his finkin' ass off.
He was drowned out by shouts of approval. Men turned violently to look at me. I felt choked. I wanted to drop my head but face them, as though facing them was itself a denial of his statements. Another voice ripped out of the shouts of approval, spilling with great urgency from the lips of a little fellow with glasses who spoke with the index finger of one hand upraised and the thumb of the other crooked in the suspender of his overalls.
I want to put this brother's remarks in the form of a motion. I move that we determine through a thorough investigation whether the new worker is a fink or no, and if he is a fink, let us discover who he's finking for. And this, brother members, would give the worker time, if he ain't a fink, to become acquainted with the work of the union and its aims. After all, brothers, we don't want to forget that workers like him aren't so highly developed as some of us who've been in the labor movement for a long time. So, I says, let's give him time to see what we've done to improve the condition of the workers. And then, if he ain't a fink, we can decide in a democratic way whether we want to accept this brother into the union. Brother union members, I thank you.
He sat down with a bump. The room roared. Biting anger grew inside me. So I was not so highly developed as they? What did he mean? Were they all PhDs? I couldn't move. Too much was happening to me. It was as though by entering the room I had automatically applied for membership, even though I had no idea that a union existed and had come up simply to get a cold pork chop sandwich. I stood trembling, afraid that they would ask me to join, but angry that so many rejected me on sight. And worst of all, I knew they were forcing me to accept things on their own terms, and I was unable to leave.
All right, brothers, we'll take a vote, the chairman shouted. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
The ayes drowned him out.
The ayes carried it,
the chairman announced as several men turned to stare at me. At last I could move. I started out forgetting why I had come.
Come in, brother, the chairman called. You can get your lunch now. Let him through. You brothers around the door.
My face stung as though it had been slapped. They had made the decision without giving me a chance to speak for myself. I felt that every man present looked upon me with hostility, and though I had lived with hostility all my life, now, for the first time, it seemed to reach me as though I had expected more of these men than others, even though I had not known of their existence. Here in this room, my defenses were negated, stripped away, checked at the door, as the weapons, the knives and razors and owl-head pistols of the country boys were checked on Saturday night at the Golden Day. I kept my eyes lowered, mumbling, "Pardon me, pardon me," all the way to the drab green locker, where I removed the sandwich for which I no longer had an appetite, and stood fumbling with the bag, dreading to face the men on my way out. Then, still hating myself for the apologies made coming over, I brushed past silently as I went back. When I reached the door, the chairman called,
"Just a minute, brother. We want you to understand that this is nothing against you personally. What you see here is the results of certain conditions here at the plant. We want you to know that we are only trying to protect ourselves. Someday we hope to have you as a member in good standing."
From here and there came a half-hearted applause that quickly died. I swallowed and stared, unseeing, the words spurting to me from a red, misty distance.
"Okay, brothers," the voice said. "Let him pass."
I stumbled through the bright sunlight of the yard, past the office workers chatting on the grass, back to building number 2. To the basement. I stood on the stairs feeling as though my bowels had been flooded with acid. Why hadn't I simply left, I thought with anguish. And since I had remained, why hadn't I said something, defended myself? Suddenly I snatched the wrapper off a sandwich and tore it violently with my teeth, hardly tasting the dry lumps that squeezed past my constricted throat when I swallowed. Dropping the remainder back into the bag, I held on to the handrail, my legs shaking, as though I had just escaped a great danger. Finally it went away, and I pushed open the metal door.
"What kept you so long?"
Brockway snapped from where he sat on a wheelbarrow. He had been drinking from a white mug now cupped in his grimy hands. I looked at him abstractedly, seeing how the light caught on his wrinkled forehead, his snowy hair.
"I said, what kept you so long?"
What had he to do with it, I thought, looking at him through a kind of mist, knowing that I disliked him and that I was very tired.
"I say,"
he began, and I heard my voice come quiet from my tense throat as I noticed by the clock that I had been gone only 20 minutes. "I ran into a union meeting."
"Union?"
I heard his white cup shatter against the floor as he uncrossed his legs, rising.
"I knowed you belonged to that bunch of trouble-making foreigners. I knowed it. Get out," he screamed. "Get out of my basement."
He started toward me as in a dream, trembling like the needle of one of the gauges as he pointed toward the stairs, his voice shrieking. I stared. Something seemed to have gone wrong. My reflexes were jammed. "But what's the matter?" I stammered, my voice low and my mind understanding and yet failing exactly to understand. "What's wrong?"
"You heard me. Get out."
"But I don't understand."
"Shut up and get."
"But Mr. Brockway," I cried, fighting to hold something that was giving way.
"You two-bit trouble-making union louse.
Look, man," I cried urgently, "now I don't belong to any union."
"If you don't get out of here, you low-down skunk," he said, looking wildly about the floor, "I'm liable to kill you. The Lord being my witness, I'll kill you."
It was incredible. Things were speeding up. "You'll do what?" I stammered.
"I'll kill you. That's what..."
He said it again, and something fell away from me, and I seemed to be telling myself in a rush, You were trained to accept the foolishness of such old men as this, even when you thought them clowns and fools. You were trained to pretend that you respected them and acknowledged in them the same quality of authority and power in your world as the whites before whom they bowed and scraped and feared and loved and imitated. And you were even trained to accept it when, angered or spiteful or drunk with power, they came at you with a stick or strap or cane, and you made no effort to strike back, but only to escape, unmarked. But this was too much. He was not my grandfather or uncle or father or preacher or teacher. Something uncoiled in my stomach, and I was moving toward him, shouting more at a black blur that irritated my eyes than at a clearly defined human face. You'll kill who? You! That's who? Listen here, you old fool. Don't talk about killing me. Give me a chance to explain. I don't belong to anything. Go on. Pick it up. Go on, I yelled, seeing his eyes fasten upon a twisted iron bar. You're old enough to be my grandfather, but if you touch that bar, I swear I'll make you eat it. I done told you. Get out of my basement, you impudent some bitch, he screamed. I moved forward, seeing him stoop and reach aside for the bar, and I was throwing myself forward, feeling him go over with a grunt, hard against the floor, rolling beneath the force of my lunge. It was as though I had landed upon a wiry rat. He scrambled beneath me, making angry sounds and striking my face as he tried to use the bar. I twisted it from his grasp, feeling a sharp pain stab through my shoulder. He's using a knife, flashed through my mind, and I slashed out with my elbow, sharp against his face, feeling it land solid and seeing his head fly backwards and up and back again as I struck again, hearing something fly free and skitter across the floor, thinking it's gone. Then knife is gone, and struck again as he tried to choke me, jabbing at his bobbing head, feeling the bar come free and bringing it down at his head, missing, the metal clinking against the floor and bringing it up for a second try, and him yelling, "No, no, you the best, you the best. I'm gonna beat your brains out," I said, my throat dry. "Stabbing me? No," he panted. I got enough. Ain't you heard me say I got enough? So, when you can't win, you want to stop. Damn you, if you've cut me bad, I'll tear your head off. Watching him warily, I got to my feet. I dropped the bar as a flash of heat swept over me. His face was caved in. "What's wrong with you, old man?" I yelled nervously. "Don't you know better than to attack a man a third your age?" He blanched at being called old, and I repeated it, adding insults I'd heard my grandfather use. "Why, you old-fashioned slavery-time, mammy-made, handkerchief-headed bastard. You should know better. What made you think you could threaten my life? You meant nothing to me. I came down here because I was sent. I didn't know anything about you or the Union either. Why'd you start riding me the minute I came in? Are you people crazy? Does this paint go to your head? Are you drinking it?" He glared, panting tiredly. Great tucks showed in his overalls where the folds were stuck together by the goo with which he was covered, and I thought, tar baby, and wanted to blot him out of my sight. But now my anger was flowing fast from actions to words. I go to get my lunch, and they ask me who I work for, and when I tell them, they call me a fink. A fink! You people must be out of your minds. No sooner do I get back down here than you start yelling that you're going to kill me. What's going on? What if you got against me? What did I do? He glowered at me silently, then pointed to the floor. "Reach and draw back a nub," I warned. "Can't a man even get his teeth?" he mumbled, his voice strange. "Teeth?" With a shamed frown, he opened his mouth. I saw a blue flash of shrunken gums. The thing that had skittered across the floor was not a knife, but a plate of false teeth. For a fraction of a second, I was desperate, feeling some of my justification for wanting to kill him slipping away. My fingers leaped to my shoulder, finding wet cloth, but no blood. The old fool had bitten me. A wild flash of laughter struggled to rise from beneath my anger. He had bitten me. I looked on the floor, seeing the smashed mug and the teeth glinting dully across the room. "Get them," I said, growing ashamed. Without his teeth, some of the hatefulness seemed to have gone out of him. But I stayed close as he got his teeth and went over to the tap and held them beneath a stream of water. A tooth fell away beneath the pressure of his thumb. and I heard him grumbling as he placed the plate in his mouth. Then, wiggling his chin, he became himself again.
"You was really trying to kill me,"
he said. He seemed unable to believe it. "You started the killing. I don't go around fighting," I said. "Why didn't you let me explain? Is it against the law to belong to the union?"
"That damn union," he cried almost in tears. "That damn union. They after my job. I know they after my job. For one of us to join one of them damn unions, it's like we was to bite the hand of the man who teached us to bathe in a bathtub. I hates it, and I mean to keep on doing all I can to chase it out of the plant. They after my job, the chicken shit bastards."
Spittle formed at the corners of his mouth. He seemed to boil with hatred. "But what do I have to do with that?" I said, feeling suddenly the older.
"'Cause them young colored fellas up in the lab is trying to join that outfit, that's what. You hear the white man done give them jobs," he wheezed as though pleading a case. "You done give them good jobs, too, and they so ungrateful. They goes and joins up with the backbiting union. I never seen such a no-good, ungrateful bunch. All they doing is making things bad for the rest of us."
"Well, I'm sorry," I said. I didn't know about all that. I came here to take a temporary job, and I certainly didn't intend to get mixed up in any quarrels. But as for us, I'm ready to forget our disagreement, if you are." I held up my hand, causing my shoulder to pain. He gave me a gruff look.
"You ought to have more self-respect than to fight an old man," he said. "I got grown boys older than you."
"I thought you were trying to kill me," I said, my hand still extended. "I thought you had stabbed me."
"Well, I don't like a lot of bickering and confusion myself," he said,
avoiding my eyes. And it was as though the closing of his sticky hand over mine was a signal. I heard a shrill hissing from the boilers behind me and turned, hearing Brockway yell,
"I told you to watch them gauges. Get over to the big valves, quick!"
I dashed for where a series of valve wheels projected from the wall near the crusher, seeing Brockway scrambling away in the other direction, thinking, "Where's he going?" As I reached the valves and hearing him yell,
"Turn it! Turn it!"
"Which?" I yelled, reaching.
"The white one, fool! The white one!"
I jumped, catching it and pulling it down with all my weight, feeling it give. But this only increased the noise, and I seemed to hear Brockway laugh as I looked around to see him scrambling for the stairs, his hands clasping the back of his head and his neck pulled in close like a small boy who has thrown a brick into the air.
"Hey, you! Hey, you!" I yelled. "Hey!"
But it was too late. All my movements seemed too slow, ran together. I felt the wheel resisting and tried vainly to reverse it and tried to let go, and it sticking to my palms and my fingers stiff and sticky. And I turned, running now, seeing the needle on one of the gauges swinging madly like a beacon gone out of control, and trying to think clearly, my eyes darting here and there, through the room of tanks and machines and up the stairs so far away, and hearing the clear new note arising while I seemed to run swiftly up an incline and shot forward with sudden acceleration into a wet blast of black emptiness that was somehow a bath of whiteness. It was a fall into space that seemed not a fall but a suspension. Then a great weight landed upon me, and I seemed to sprawl in an interval of clarity beneath a pile of broken machinery, my head pressed back against a huge wheel, my body splattered with a stinking goo. Somewhere an engine ground in furious futility, grating loudly until a pain shot around the curve of my head and bounced me off into blackness for a distance, only to strike another pain that lobbed me back. And in that clear instant of consciousness, I opened my eyes to a blinding flash. Holding on grimly, I could hear the sound of someone wading, sloshing nearby, and an old man's garrulous voice saying,
"I told them these here young 1900 boys ain't no good for the job. They ain't got the nerves. No, sir, they just ain't got the nerves."
I tried to speak, to answer, but something heavy moved again, and I was understanding something fully and trying again to answer, but seemed to sink to the center of a lake of heavy water and pause, transfixed and numb. with the sense that I had lost, irrevocably, an important victory. I was sitting in a cold, white, rigid chair, and a man was looking at me out of a bright third eye that glowed from the center of his forehead. He reached out, touching my skull gingerly, and said something encouraging, as though I were a child. His fingers went away. "Take this," he said. "It's good for you." I swallowed. Suddenly, my skin itched all over. I had on new overalls, strange white ones. The taste ran bitter through my mouth. My fingers trembled. A thin voice with a mirror on the end of it said,
"How is he?"
"I don't think it's anything serious, merely stunned."
"Should he be sent home now?"
"No, just to be certain, we'll keep him here for a few days. Want to keep him under observation. Then he may leave." Now I was lying on a cot, the bright eye still burning into mine, although the man was gone. It was quiet, and I was numb. I closed my eyes only to be awakened.
"What is your name?" a voice said.
"My head," I said.
"Yes, but your name? Address?"
"My head, that burning eye," I said.
"Eye?"
"Inside," I said.
"Shoot him up for an X-ray,"
another voice said.
My head."
"Careful."
Somewhere, a machine began to hum, and I distrusted the man and woman above me. They were holding me firm, and it was fiery, and above it all, I kept hearing the opening motif of Beethoven's Fifth. Three short and one long buzz, repeated again and again in varying volume, and I was struggling and breaking through, rising up to find myself lying on my back with two pink-faced men laughing down.
"Be quiet now," one of them said firmly. "You'll be all right."
I raised my eyes, seeing two indefinite young women in white looking down at me. A third, a desert of heat waves away, sat at a panel arrayed with coils and dials. Where was I? From far below me, a barber chair thumping began, and I felt myself rise on the tip of the sound from the floor. A face was now level with mine, looking closely and saying something without meaning. A whirring began that snapped and cracked with static, and suddenly I seemed to be crushed between the floor and ceiling. Two forces tore savagely at my stomach and back. A flash of cold-edged heat enclosed me. I was pounded between crushing electrical pressures, pumped between live electrodes like an accordion between a player's hands. My lungs were compressed like a bellows, and each time my breath returned, I yelled, punctuating the rhythmical action of the nodes.
"Hush, goddammit," one of the voices ordered. "We're trying to get you started again. Now shut up."
The voice throbbed with icy authority, and I quieted and tried to contain the pain. I discovered now that my head was encircled by a piece of cold metal like the iron cap worn by the occupant of an electric chair. I tried unsuccessfully to struggle, to cry out, but the people were so remote, the pain so immediate. A face moved in and out of the circle of lights, peering for a moment, then disappeared. A freckled, red-haired woman with gold nose glasses appeared. Then a man with a circular mirror attached to his forehead. A doctor. Yes, he was a doctor, and the women were nurses. It was coming clear. I was in a hospital. They would care for me. It was all geared toward the easing of pain. Ah, I felt thankful. I tried to remember how I'd gotten here, but nothing came. My mind was blank, as though I had just begun to live. When the next face appeared, I saw the eyes behind the thick glasses blinking, as though noticing me for the first time. "You're all right, boy. You're okay. You just be patient," said the voice, hollow with profound attachment. I seemed to go away. The lights receded like a
taillight racing down a dark country road. I couldn't follow. A sharp pain stabbed my shoulder. I twisted about on my back, fighting something I couldn't see. Then after a while, my vision cleared. Now a man sitting with his back to me, manipulating dials on a panel. I wanted to call him, but the Fifth Symphony rhythm racked me, and he seemed too serene and too far away. Bright metal bars were between us, and when I strained my neck around, I discovered that I was not lying on an operating table, but in a kind of glass and nickel box, the lid of which was propped open. Why was I here?
Doctor! Doctor!
I called. No answer. Perhaps he hadn't heard, I thought. Calling again and feeling the stabbing pulses of the machine again and feeling myself going under and fighting against it and coming up to hear voices carrying on a conversation behind my head. The static sounds became a quiet drone. Strains of music, a Sunday air drifted from a distance. With closed eyes, barely breathing, I warded off the pain. The voices droned harmoniously. Was it a radio I heard? A phonograph? The vox humana of a hidden organ? If so, what organ and where? I felt warm. Green hedges, dazzling with red wild roses, appeared behind my eyes, stretching with a gentle curving to an infinity empty of objects, a limpid blue space. Scenes of a shaded lawn in summer drifted past. I saw a uniformed military band arrayed decorously in concert. Each musician with well-oiled hair heard a sweet-voiced trumpet rendering the holy city as from an echoing distance, buoyed by a choir of muted horns, and above, the mocking obbligato of a mockingbird. I felt giddy. The air seemed to grow thick with fine, white gnats filling my eyes, boiling so thickly that the dark trumpeter breathed them in and expelled them through the bell of his golden horn, a live white cloud mixing with the tones upon the torpid air. I came back. The voices still droned above me, and I disliked them. Why didn't they go away? Smug ones.
Oh, doctor,
I thought drowsily, did you ever wade in a brook before breakfast, ever chew on sugar cane? You know, Doc, the same fall day I first saw the hounds chasing black men in stripes and chains, my grandmother sat with me and sang with twinkling eyes.
God Almighty made a monkey, God Almighty made a whale, and God Almighty made a gator with hickeys all over his tail.
Or you, nurse, did you know that when you strolled in pink organdy and picture hat between the rows of Cape jasmine cooing to your bow in a drawl as thick as sorghum, we little black boys hidden snug in the bushes called out so loud that you daren't hear?
Did you ever see Miss Margaret boil water? Man, she hisses a wonderful stream. 17 miles and a quarter. Man, and you can't see her pot for the steam.
But now the music became a distinct wail of female pain. I opened my eyes. Glass and metal floated above me.
How are you feeling, boy?
A voice said. A pair of eyes peered down through lenses as thick as the bottom of a Coca-Cola bottle, eyes protruding, luminous and vain like an old biology specimen preserved in alcohol.
I don't have enough room, I said angrily.
Oh, that's a necessary part of the treatment.
But I need more room, I insisted. I'm cramped.
Don't worry about it, boy. You'll get used to it after a while. How is your stomach and head?
Stomach?
Yes. And your head?
I don't know,
I said, realizing that I could feel nothing beyond the pressure around my head and on the tender surface of my body. Yet my senses seemed to focus sharply.
I don't feel it, I cried, alarmed.
Aha! You see? My little gadget will solve everything, he exploded.
I don't know, another voice said. I think I still prefer surgery, and in this case especially with this, background, I'm not so sure that I don't believe in the effectiveness of simple prayer.
Nonsense. From now on, do your praying to my little machine. I'll deliver the cure.
I don't know, but I believe it a mistake to assume that solutions, cures, that is, that apply in, primitive instances are, equally effective when more advanced conditions are in question. Suppose it were a New Englander with a Harvard background.
Now you're arguing politics, the first voice said banteringly.
Oh, no, but it is a problem.
I listened with growing uneasiness to the conversation fuzzing away to a whisper. The simplest words seemed to refer to something else, as did many of the notions that unfurled through my head. I wasn't sure whether they were talking about me or someone else. Some of it sounded like a discussion of history. The machine will produce the results of a prefrontal lobotomy without the negative effects of the knife, the voice said. You see, instead of severing the prefrontal lobe, a single lobe, that is, we apply pressure in the proper degrees to the major centers of nerve control. Our concept is gestalt, and the result is as complete a change of personality as you'll find in your famous fairy tale cases of criminals transformed into amiable fellows after all that bloody business of a brain operation. And what's more, the voice went on triumphantly, the patient is both physically and neurally whole.
But what of his psychology?
Absolutely of no importance, the voice said. The patient will live as he has to live, and with absolute integrity. Who could ask more? He'll experience no major conflict of motives, and what is even better, society will suffer no traumata on his account. There was a pause. A pen scratched upon paper. Then,
why not castration, doctor?
A voice asked waggishly, causing me to start, a pain tearing through me. There goes your love of blood again, the first voice laughed. What's that definition of a surgeon? A butcher with a bad conscience? They laughed.
It's not so funny. It would be more scientific to try to define the case. It has been developing some 300 years.
Define? Hell, man, we know all that.
Then why don't you try more current?
You suggested.
I do. Why not?
But isn't there a danger? The voice trailed off. I heard them move away. A chair scraped. The machine droned, and I knew definitely that they were discussing me and steeled myself for the shocks, but was blasted nevertheless. The pulse came swift and staccato, increasing gradually until I fairly danced between the nodes. My teeth chattered. I closed my eyes and bit my lips to smother my screams. Warm blood filled my mouth between my lids. I saw a circle of hands and faces dazzling with light. Some were scribbling upon charts.
Look, he's dancing, someone called.
No, really? An oily face looked in.
They really do have rhythm, don't they? Get hot, boy, get hot, it said with a laugh.
And suddenly my bewilderment suspended, and I wanted to be angry, murderously angry. But somehow the pulse of current smashing through my body prevented me. Something had been disconnected. For though I had seldom used my capacities for anger and indignation, I had no doubt that I possessed them, and like a man who knows that he must fight whether angry or not, when called a son of a bitch, I tried to imagine myself angry, only to discover a deeper sense of remoteness. I was beyond anger. I was only bewildered, and those above seemed to sense it. There was no avoiding the shock, and I rolled with the agitated tide out into the blackness. When I emerged, the lights were still there. I lay beneath the slab of glass, feeling deflated. All my limbs seemed amputated. It was very warm. A dim white ceiling stretched far above me. My eyes were swimming with tears. Why, I didn't know. It worried me. I wanted to knock on the glass to attract attention, but I couldn't move. The slightest effort, hardly more than desire, tired me. I lay experiencing the vague processes of my body. I seemed to have lost all sense of proportion. Where did my body end and the crystal and white world begin? Thoughts evaded me, hiding in the vast stretch of clinical whiteness to which I seemed connected only by a scale of receding grays. No sounds beyond the sluggish inner roar of the blood. I couldn't open my eyes. I seemed to exist in some other dimension, utterly alone, until, after a while, a nurse bent down and forced a warm fluid between my lips. I gagged, swallowed, feeling the fluid course slowly to my vague middle. A huge, iridescent bubble seemed to enfold me. Gentle hands moved over me, bringing vague impressions of memory. I was laved with warm liquids, felt gentle hands move through the indefinite limits of my flesh. The sterile and weightless texture of a sheet enfolded me. I felt myself bounce, sail off like a ball, thrown over the roof into mist, striking a hidden wall beyond a pile of broken machinery and sailing back. How long it took, I didn't know. But now, above the movement of the hands, I heard a friendly voice uttering familiar words to which I could assign no meaning. I listened intensely, aware of the form and movement of sentences and grasping the now subtle rhythmical differences between progressions of sound that questioned and those that made a statement, but still their meanings were lost in the vast whiteness in which I myself was lost. Other voices emerged. Faces hovered above me like inscrutable fish peering myopically through a glass aquarium wall. I saw them suspended, motionless, above me, then two floating off, first their heads, then the tips of their fin-like fingers, moving dreamily from the top of the case. A thoroughly mysterious coming and going, like the surging of torpid tides. I watched the two make furious movements with their mouths. I didn't understand. They tried again, the meaning still escaping me. I felt uneasy. I saw a scribbled card held over me, all a jumble of alphabets. They consulted heatedly. Somehow I felt responsible. A terrible sense of loneliness came over me. They seemed to enact a mysterious pantomime, and seeing them from this angle was disturbing. They appeared utterly stupid, and I didn't like it. It wasn't right. I could see smut in one doctor's nose. A nurse had two flabby chins. Other faces came up, their mouths working with soundless fury. But we are all human, I thought, wondering what I meant. A man dressed in black appeared, a long-haired fellow whose piercing eyes looked down upon me out of an intense and friendly face. The others hovered about him, their eyes anxious, as he alternately peered at me and consulted my chart. Then he scribbled something on a large card and thrust it before my eyes. "What is your name?" A tremor shook me. It was as though he had suddenly given a name to, had organized the vagueness that drifted through my head, and I was overcome with swift shame. I realized I no longer knew my own name. I shut my eyes and shook my head with sorrow. Here was the first warm attempt to communicate with me, and I was failing. I tried again, plunging into the blackness of my mind. It was no use. I found nothing but pain. I saw the card again, and he pointed slowly to each word. "What is your name?" I tried desperately. diving below the blackness until I was limp with fatigue. It was as though a vein had been opened and my energy siphoned away. I could only stare back mutely. But with an irritating burst of activity, he gestured for another card and wrote, "Who are you?" Something inside me turned with a sluggish excitement. This phrasing of the question seemed to set off a series of weak and distant lights where the other had thrown a spark that failed. Who am I? I asked myself. But it was like trying to identify one particular cell that coursed through the torpid veins of my body. Maybe I was just this blackness and bewilderment and pain, but that seemed less like a suitable answer than something I'd read somewhere. The card was back again. "What is your mother's name?" Mother. Who was my mother? Mother. The one who screams when you suffer, but... Who? This is stupid. You always know your mother's name. Who was it that screamed? Mother! But the scream came from the machine. A machine? My mother? Oh, clearly I was out of my head. He shot questions at me. Where were you born? Try to think of your name. I tried, thinking vainly of many names, but none seemed to fit, and yet it was as though I was somehow a part of all of them, had become submerged within them and lost. You must remember, the placard read. But it was useless. Each time I found myself back in the clinging white mist in my name just beyond my fingertips. I shook my head and watched him disappear for a moment and return with a companion, a short, scholarly-looking man who stared at me with a blank expression. I watched him produce a child's slate and a piece of chalk, writing upon it, "Who was your mother?" I looked at him, feeling a quick dislike and thinking, "Have an amusement. I don't play the dozens. And how's your old lady today?" "Think," I stared, seeing him frown and write a long time. The slate was filled with meaningless names. I smiled, seeing his eyes blaze with annoyance. Old friendly face said something. The new man wrote a question at which I stared in wide-eyed amazement. "Who was Buckeye the Rabbit?" I was filled with turmoil. Why should he think of that? He pointed to the question, word by word. I laughed deep, deep inside me, giddy with the delight of self-discovery and the desire to hide it somehow. I was Buckeye the Rabbit, or had been, when as children we danced and sang barefoot in the dusty streets. Buckeye the Rabbit, shake it, Buckeye the Rabbit, break it. Yes, I could not bring myself to admit it. It was too ridiculous and somehow too dangerous. It was... annoying that he had hit upon an old identity, and I shook my head, seeing him purse his lips and eye me sharply. "Boy, who was Brer Rabbit?" "He's your mother's back door man," I thought. "Anyone knew they were one and the same, Buckeye, when you were very young and hid yourself behind wide innocent eyes, Brer, when you were older. But why was he playing around with these childish names? Did he think I was a child? Why didn't they leave me alone? I would remember soon enough when they let me out of the machine." A palm smacked sharply upon the glass, but I was tired of them. Yet as my eyes focused upon old friendly face, he seemed pleased. I couldn't understand it, but there he was, smiling and leaving with the new assistant. Left alone, I lay fretting over my identity. I suspected that I was really playing a game with myself and that they were taking part, a kind of combat. Actually, they knew as well as I, and I, for some reason, preferred not to face it. It was irritating, and it made me feel sly and alert. I would solve the mystery the next instant. I imagined myself whirling about in my mind like an old man attempting to catch a small boy in some mischief, thinking, who am I?
It's no good!
I felt like a clown, nor was I up to being both criminal and detective, though why criminal, I didn't know. I fell to plotting ways of short-circuiting the machine. Perhaps if I shifted my body about so that the two nodes would come together... No. Not only was there no room, but it might electrocute me. I shuddered. Whoever else I was no Samson. I had no desire to destroy myself, even if I destroyed the machine. I wanted freedom, not destruction. It was exhausting, for no matter what the scheme I conceived, there was one constant flaw. Myself! There was no getting around it. I could no more escape than I could think of my identity. Perhaps, I thought, the two things are involved with each other. When I discover who I am, I'll be free. It was as though my thoughts of escape had alerted them. I looked up to see two agitated physicians, a nurse, and thought, it's too late now, and lay in a veil of sweat watching them manipulate the controls. I was braced for the usual shock, but nothing happened. Instead, I saw their hands at the lid loosening the bolt, and before I could react, they opened the lid and pulled me erect. What's happened? I began, seeing the nurse pause to look at me.
Well,
she said. My mouth worked soundlessly.
Come on, get it out, she said.
What hospital is this, I said.
It's the factory hospital, she said. Now, be quiet.
They were around me now, inspecting my body, and I watched with growing bewilderment, thinking, what is a factory hospital? I felt a tug in my belly and looked down to see one of the physicians pull the cord, which was attached to the stomach node, jerking me forward. What is this? I said.
Get the shears, he said.
Sure, the other said. Let's not waste time. I recoiled inwardly as though the cord were part of me. Then they had it free, and the nurse clipped through the belly band and removed the heavy node. I opened my mouth to speak, but one of the physicians shook his head. They worked swiftly. The nodes off, the nurse went over me with rubbing alcohol. Then I was told to climb out of the case. I looked from face to face, overcome with indecision. For now that it appeared that I was being freed, I dared not believe it. What if they were transferring me to some even more painful machine? I sat there, refusing to move. Should I struggle against them?
Take his arm, one of them said.
I can do it, I said, climbing fearfully out. I was told to stand while they went over my body with the stethoscope.
How's the articulation? The one with the chart said as the other examined my shoulder.
Perfect, he said.
I could feel a tightness there, but no pain.
I'd say he's surprisingly strong, considering, the other said.
Shall we call in Drexel? It seems rather unusual for him to be so strong.
Now, just note it on the chart.
All right. Nurse, give him his clothes.
What are you going to do with me? I said.
She handed me clean underclothing and a pair of white overalls.
No questions, she said. Just dress as quickly as possible.
The air outside the machine seemed extremely rare. When I bent over to tie my shoes, I thought I would faint, but fought it off. I stood shakily, and they looked me up and down.
Well, boy, it looks as though you're cured, one of them said. You're a new man. You came through fine. Come with us, he said.
We went slowly out of the room and down a long white corridor into an elevator, then swiftly down three floors to a reception room with rows of chairs. At the front were a number of private offices with frosted glass doors and walls.
Sit down there, they said. The director will see you shortly. I sat, seeing them disappear inside one of the offices for a second and emerge, passing me without a word. I trembled like a leaf. Were they really freeing me? My head spun. I looked at my white overalls. The nurse said that this was the factory hospital. I could not remember what kind of factory it was, and why a factory hospital. Yes, I did remember some vague factory. Perhaps I was being sent back there. Yes, and he'd spoken of the director instead of the head doctor. Could they be one and the same? Perhaps I was in the factory already. I listened, but could hear no machinery. Across the room, a newspaper lay on a chair, but I was too concerned to get it. Somewhere a fan droned. Then one of the doors with frosted glass was opened, and I saw a tall, austere-looking man in a white coat beckoning to me with a chart.
Come,
he said. I got up and went past him into a large, simply furnished office, thinking, now, I'll know, now.
Sit down, he said.
I eased myself into the chair beside his desk. He watched me with a calm, scientific gaze.
What is your name?
Oh, here, I have it, he said, studying the chart. And it was as though someone inside of me tried to tell him to be silent, but already he had called my name, and I heard myself say, oh! As a pain stabbed through my head, and I shot to my feet and looked wildly around me and sat down and got up and down again very fast, remembering. I don't know why I did it, but suddenly I saw him looking at me intently, and I stayed down this time. He began asking questions, and I could hear myself replying fluently, though inside I was reeling with swiftly changing emotional images that shrilled and chattered like a soundtrack reversed at high speed.
Well, my boy, he said, you're cured. We are going to release you. How does that strike you?
Suddenly I didn't know. I noticed a company calendar beside a stethoscope and a miniature silver paintbrush. Did he mean from the hospital or from the job? Sir, I said.
I said, how does that strike you?
All right, sir, I said in an unreal voice. I'll be glad to get back to work. He looked at the chart, frowning.
You'll be released, but I'm afraid that you'll be disappointed about the work, he said.
What do you mean, sir?
You've been through a severe experience, he said. You aren't ready for the rigors of industry. Now, I want you to rest. Undertake a period of convalescence. You need to become readjusted and get your strength back.
But, sir, you mustn't try to go too fast.
You're glad to be released, are you not?
Oh, yes. But how shall I live?
Live?
His eyebrows raised and lowered.
Take another job, he said. Something easier, quieter. Something for which you're better prepared.
Prepared. I looked at him, thinking, is he in on it too?
I'll take anything, sir, I said. That isn't the problem, my boy. You just aren't prepared for work under our industrial conditions. Later, perhaps, but not now. And remember, you'll be adequately compensated for your experience.
Compensated, sir?
Oh, yes, he said. We follow a policy of enlightened humanitarianism. All our employees are automatically insured. You have only to sign a few papers.
What kind of papers, sir?
We require an affidavit releasing the company of responsibility, he said. Yours was a difficult case, and a number of specialists had to be called in. But, after all, any new occupation has its hazards. They are part of growing up, of becoming adjusted, as it were. One takes a chance, and while some are prepared, others are not.
I looked at his lined face. Was he doctor, factory official, or both? I couldn't get it. Now he seemed to move back and forth across my field of vision, although he sat perfectly calm in his chair. It came out
of itself. Do you know, Mr. Norton, sir? I said.
Norton?
His brows knitted. What Norton is this? Then it was as though I hadn't asked him. The name sounded strange. I ran my hand over my eyes. I'm sorry, I said. It occurred